From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we plan to have a rather typical conversation with the New York State lawmaker about the recently passed state budget and state business. Recently on this program, you heard State Senator Jeremy Cooney, a Democrat. Today, our guest is a Republican, State Senator Edward Rath III. Senator Rath's district covers parts of the Buffalo area all the way to the city of Rochester. The mass shooting in Buffalo this weekend has shifted some of the focus of this conversation. The shooting was a racist hate crime. A white man from the Southern Tier who intentionally drove several hours to a mostly black neighborhood. His manifesto is detailed and chilling. In response, what do we need to learn? What is the right response to this tragedy? Senator Rath will weigh in on that and much more this hour. Senator Edward Rath III, welcome back to Connections. Thank you for making the time.
Good afternoon, Evan. I'm happy to be back.
Can you give me a sense for your first reaction to the news of the tragedy this weekend?
Absolutely. First and foremost, my deepest sympathy go out to the families, the loved ones, and our entire community who are all in a total state of shock. And I'm a lifelong Buffalonian, and it is heartbreaking to see this happen anywhere, but certainly when it hits home right in our community, and it is a full-scale tragedy. And one of the things that we do in Western New York is we rise up, and the outpouring of support that we've seen is truly touching, and it's going to help us to heal in this very, very difficult time. And I'll tell you, this hatred and violence that we saw, I condemn this act at the highest level. I condemn this type of racism, and I condemn this type of inexcusable, sickening, and evil behavior.
Is there a response that will allow the healing? I mean, when you talk about the importance of healing, certainly that has to happen. How? What's the path forward here?
I think first and foremost, as a community, we have to come together and unify against this type of hatred and this type of evil, which has no place anywhere in our society. And as I said earlier, our prayers and our thoughts go out to the families. And in general, I think that this is a time for us to come together as a government, come together as a community, and come together as a region to make sure that we do everything to support the families. And we've already seen in the news today giveaways of groceries because the supermarket Tops on the east side of Buffalo is closed. We have seen GoFundMe pages to provide money and resources for the families who are going to be confronted with some major challenges. And that's what we do in Western New York. It is a city of good neighbors. They call Buffalo that. I actually call Western New York the region of good neighbors. And we will rise up to support these families who are struggling right now.
Is there a state government policy response that is needed here?
I think one of the things that we have to do is take it slow with regards to policy and look very closely at some of the challenges that we have with regards to mental health and mental health services and the funding and the closure of facilities that we've seen in Buffalo was announced just the other day. That's a major concern. The red flag laws, which potentially should have caught this behavior because of some of the things that he was identified as saying and threatening last year in his hometown community. How can we look at those red flag laws and make sure that they are properly working and the state agencies that are responsible for imposing the oversight of red flag laws is working properly? There's a lot to this. There's a ton to unpack. But I think as a government, we shouldn't be making any brash or rush decisions immediately without making sure that we're getting it right, our response.
Did you read his manifesto, the shooter?
I read portions of it, and it is deeply distressing.
Yeah, no question about it. And the shooter, so let me ask you a little bit about mental health before we get to some of the other things he wrote. And I'm not going to quote him. I mean, listeners, unfortunately, can probably find it very easily if you want to. But when you talk about mental health here, I don't want to assume that what you're saying is the shooter was mentally ill. And I'm not a professional in terms of psychiatry or psychology. I can understand why some people would presume that you have to be mentally ill to carry out an attack like this. But I'm not certain that that's true. I think he's pretty clear in his beliefs and why he got to where he is, where that came from. It came from 4chan and some of the dark corners of the internet, primarily during COVID, he writes. But I don't know. Do you believe, Senator, that he has to be mentally ill to commit an act like this?
I think on some level, yes, because obviously this is abhorrent behavior that has senselessly taken the lives of 10 of my fellow Western New Yorkers. So maybe not in a clinical definition, but certainly there's something mentally very, very wrong with him, no doubt about it. And, you know, the fact that we have last June, I believe it was, where he was threatening violent behavior potentially at his school. And, you know, there was a little bit of a pattern potentially on social media that we may have been seeing. We need to make sure that we are, I think, number one, as I said earlier, prioritizing and funding and making sure that mental health services, there's access and there's success within those services, but then also making sure that our red flag laws are operating properly. You know, this was a state agency that should have been conducting that follow-up. So we need to, like I said earlier, take this relatively slowly, make sure that we protect our communities, and part of it is a red flag law, and part of it is making sure that our mental health services and our mental health facilities and our mental health professionals are properly funded and properly empowered to do their jobs.
Okay. What is a red flag law for those who are not familiar?
Well, in general, the way I understand red flag laws is that there is a pattern of behavior or there is information that tips off state agencies that someone is unstable and someone has perhaps research or has information they've posted online that says that there might be violent or unstable behavior and there might be a real threat to our communities. That's what the red flag law is designed to identify and potentially protect our communities from that violence actually happening.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in, when you I'm trying to like get my head around how you balance freedom, how you balance liberty, with intervening before violence occurs. And that, you know, that's a very arbitrary line. There's a lot of different opinions about what is, you know, sort of signals an imminent attack, what kind of rhetoric is kind of a cry for attention or help, but not necessarily indicative of violence. Do you feel like that we've gotten better at identifying when someone really truly is likely to become violent, Senator?
Oh, I think that's a question that we need to explore because, you know, if this person was identified as a threat and then, you know, a year later, this individual was able to, like you said earlier, coordinate and meticulously plan this absolutely abhorrent and evil behavior, you know, we have, it's not working and it's not working properly right now. So that's something I think we really need to look into. But you're absolutely right. You know, there are freedoms that need to be protected. There is individuals who, you know, if the last thing you want is for this something to go far too far to the other side, where suddenly everyone's behavior is being monitored and restricted and regulated and curtailed. So there's a balance that has to be absolutely struck here. And you know, look, right now we are kind of grasping for answers and thinking of ideas and potentially looking for, you know, paths that we're going to go down to try to solve this problem. But I will tell you this, you know, our community in Western New York, we will respond properly in the support and the unity and the togetherness and the sense of community that we have to support the families. That has to be the number one priority. There's a grieving process that we need to let naturally unfold, and everyone grieves in their own way. Every single individual does, and we need to let that happen for the families.
Senator, the gunman used a Bushmaster XM-15. Have you ever fired one of those?
I don't think I've fired specifically that gun, no.
Okay. He wrote in his manifesto that there are very few weapons that are easier to use that would be able to allow you to kill a lot of people than that. Is that a weapon that should be available to the general public?
Well, I think that's a conversation that we need to have, I'm not, you know, really prepared right now to say yes, no, or maybe on, you know, specific guns and specific, you know, restrictions on guns. That's not, I don't think, anything I'm prepared to discuss at this point. Look, I will always sit around the table and be a part of the conversation when we're looking at what type of solutions we can provide.
Yeah, I understand. I guess I'm a little surprised because I don't expect you to change your views on where you've been on gun law, and the two major political parties in the state have had long debates about that. There was the SAFE Act years ago that inspired, especially in rural parts of the state, a lot of backlash, a lot of anger about gun laws, the notion that the state is too tough on guns. I guess what I'm wondering is if events like this move you at all? Because my assumption, Senator, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that up until now, your viewpoint has been, well, a weapon like Bushmaster XM-15, sure, there should not be a ban on such a weapon. What you're telling me is you're willing to have a conversation. You're not willing to say yes or no right now. Is that different than where you were a week ago?
Well, I think not really all that much different right now than it was about a week ago. But look, I'm someone who, in government in general, I will always listen to the perspective of everyone on every issue. And that's what I'm prepared to do on this issue as well. I have in the past been very clear on my position on the Second Amendment and the SAFE Act. And this is an absolute tragedy, which warrants the conversation and warrants the review. And I want to take it too much further than that at this juncture, Evan, but I will be happy to be a part of that conversation as we look at what possible solutions and every possible solution we can provide to root out this tragedy.
Okay. So finally on that, and then we're going to move on to some other subjects. Though, of course, listeners, if you want to weigh in, you can do that with Senator Edward Rath III, who is our guest here on Connections on this Monday. So I had asked you about that specific weapon, if you would be in favor of changing your views on that. Generally speaking, are you in favor, if you are in favor of changing gun laws in New York State, can you just describe for listeners what you think the ideal gun laws should be versus where we are right now in the state?
Well, I want to admit right out of the blocks here that I'm not in favor of changing gun laws in New York State. I'm willing to have the conversation right now with regards to what happened with this specific gun that was used to carry out these crimes in our communities the other day. But I don't have any specific plans for changing any gun laws right now in New York State.
Okay, not even in regards to the so-called SAFE Act or other access laws on that are currently on the books? There's nothing that you would say repeal this or change that?
Well, I did when I was in the county legislature. I was very clear in my call for the repeal of the SAFE Act, and I continue to believe that the SAFE Act was overly restrictive, and I thought that in many ways it characterized law-abiding citizens who own guns in a negative way, and in many ways it was overly restrictive. And I would continue to maintain my position that the SAFE Act should be repealed, because quite often in general in government, what we see, I believe, is an overly regulatory, overly restrictive set of policies that come through New York State. And then what we realize later on is that there needs to be some fine-tuning or some changes or things that need to be cleaned up about it. The elimination of cash bail is a perfect example of that, Evan. And I think that there's a lot we can do in New York State to improve our laws and make them more appropriate, more timely, and more effective for all the citizens in our state.
We'll get to bail reform coming up here, and I know that's part of the list of issues you'd like to talk about. I am curious to know, if you look at a state like Ohio, where the constitutional carry bill, as it's known, would make concealed weapons permits optional for those 21 and older. In other words, you don't need a permit to concealed carry in Ohio. Would you favor something like that in this state?
I think in general, I would be leaning in that direction that I would support that. But I'd have to look at the specifics, and I'd have to research it. And in every issue that I look at, I talk to all the subject matter experts, everyone, both sides of the aisle, everyone that's impacted by the legislation before I come to a decision. So I would be leaning towards that concealed carry proposal like you're talking about that they have in Ohio, but I'd have to study it before I made a final decision.
Talking to Senator Edward Rath III, whose district stretches all the way from parts of the city of Rochester to all the way to parts of the city of Buffalo, and he's a guest on this program to talk about state business. So we had Senator Jeremy Cooney on recently talking about the recent state budget and other issues. Want to let listeners know that next hour, an extended conversation about the mass shooting in Buffalo this past weekend, and we will welcome your feedback on this. If you've got feedback for Senator Rath, you can join the conversation. You can email the program. It's connections@wxxi.org, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Senator, as one of the elected leaders of this state, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the mindset of someone like this 18-year-old man who could commit a mass shooting like this, and he is concerned about changing demographics. And we are a country with changing demographics. We are a country where eventually, being white in this country, you'll be in probably a plurality, not a majority. And This man is very concerned about that. This man says, you know, that is replacing us, et cetera. We'll talk more about that next hour. But, I mean, generally speaking, how do you make sure that the fear of people who are different, that the fear of those who are not just like us, does not lead to violence, Senator?
Well, this is a behavior of an individual who was at his very core evil. And what he conducted and the crimes that were committed in our community are absolutely shocking. They are terrifying to all of us. And these are people that, these are our friends, these are our neighbors, these are individuals that we have relationships with. They could be relatives. And the outcome that he created is hopefully an isolated incident that never happens again. And we need to do whatever we can to, as a government, ensure that. And I said earlier on, and I'll continue to mention this, that mental health funding, prioritization, services, and facilities need to be made available. And I'm telling you, to me at least, this is a mental health concern, at least in part, because then you can get into the experts who can try to get into the mind of this individual and try to understand what was motivating that person and how we can potentially work on trying to root out those type of thought processes, those connections that were made, and then the strategy that he used, this coordinated strategy. It's shocking. It's very core to all of us what he did and how coordinated this was. And thank goodness for the first responders and law enforcement who were on the scene within a minute, and the brave individuals who stood up to this absolute terrorist in our communities. And the law enforcement was there in 1 minute and probably saved many, many more lives. And a portion of his plan was to actually continue his evil rampage at the tops and then to go into further into the community and continue to conduct this type of unbelievable and evil behavior. And law enforcement and first responders rooted that out. So we have to be mindful and thankful and appreciative of everything they did. And lives were lost fighting this individual as well.
Jennifer emails the program to say, I don't remember, Evan, the exact name of the kind of gun you mentioned that was used in Buffalo, but what is a good reason to be allowed to legally own one of those? What would you say to that, Senator?
What is a good reason to be allowed to own the
gun?
Yeah,
Jennifer is saying, she's talking, and by the way, Jennifer, the name of the gun is it's a Bushmaster XM15. That's what was used in Buffalo. Jennifer's saying, what's a good reason that we should be allowed to legally own those?
Well, I think that in general, gun ownership is a very complex issue, right? And there's a lot of components to it with regards to the size, the style, the type of gun, the type of magazine, a number of rounds in a magazine. And you just can't make blanket statements about this specific gun, that specific gun. Take those out of, the accessibility for individuals. We have to have this conversation with everyone around the table working on it and understanding the pros and the cons of all of it. So making just sweeping quick statements about it is I don't think, appropriate right now before we get into working on the details of it.
Listeners asking, who asked to remain anonymous, sent me a note about red flag laws and said, again, I cannot verify the story, but let me just ask the senator about maybe some of the mechanisms of red flag. The listener says that there was a high school student at a school in our region who was recently expelled because that student made a so-called kill list. And the belief is that there were access to guns in the home. And the listener is saying, shouldn't there be mandatory mental health help, not just expulsion? What does red flag call for, Senator?
That makes a lot of sense to me. It really does. I think mental health has to be at the forefront, not the afterthought. And ever since my days in county government, we, I think, underfunded, underprioritized, and underserved the mental health community. And this is in Erie County, where I was serving before, but I'm also seeing aspects of that in the state. If we can work on the mental health side of it at the front end, we could potentially provide the services to root out this evil behavior on the back end.
Talking to Senator Edward Rath, and I see a number of phone calls here. I'm not seeing who's on the lines here. We'll get to that in just a second here. But I promise we'll get to as many as we can here as we go throughout the hour with the senator, who is being generous with his time on a day that, boy, no one could have predicted what would have happened over the
There's
weekend.
There's a lot going on today, I'll
yeah,
tell you.
Yeah, no one could have predicted. Let me get Richard in Shortsville. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Firstly, I want to extend my condolences to those that are affected but I'm listening to the show, and I'm deeply concerned that the political rhetoric coming from our elected officials there and others is purely tied to mental health and not actually addressing the gun. I'm a foreign national. I've lived in this area for probably 20 years. I'm not anti-gun at all. However, I've seen, you know, we license cars, we license dogs, we have to do a lot of things around our identity with regards to, you know, passports, social security cards, etc. So I really don't see the hang-up on having to apply for a license for a gun. And I know the pushback here is going to be the Second Amendment. When I did my citizenship test, I had to study the Constitution as part of my test. And I have heard in my time here, I've heard the Second Amendment misquoted with relation to this so many times that it's almost like, I got to tell you.
In what way, Richard? Misquoted in what way?
Misquoted. Everybody says I have the right to bear arms, but that's it. And they stop at the right to bear arms. They don't understand that the right to bear arms against a well-regulated militia, which is, i.e., the government. And so when it's misquoted, it puts fire in the belly when people are thinking about, oh, my constitutional rights are being affected. But, I'm not anti-gun. I hunt. I'm a legal gun owner. So I think that, the legal people will do the right thing if that's what comes in. And I don't think it. I don't think having a license for a gun will affect your constitutional rights whatsoever. It's a hot topic.
Let me get Senator Rath on that. Go ahead, Senator.
Well, first of all, Richard, thank you for your call and thank you for your perspective. And I'm a legal gun owner as well. And I think when it comes to the Second Amendment and when it comes to any issues that are tied to gun licensing, let's have the conversation. Let's talk it through. Let's work on this as government should do. And I'm not in any way, shape, or form trying to not say that we shouldn't be having this conversation, because I'm actually encouraging the conversation for us to look at what should we be doing to protect our communities and provide the safety to our communities, while also recognizing the rights that our citizens have, our Second Amendment rights and all the other rights, freedom of speech and everything else needs to be protected. So let's go through the government process, the due diligence, working with the subject matter experts. This is literally the way that I provide my services in government, is making sure that we're thoughtful and we're practical in the way that we look at any potential changes to our laws.
Okay. Let me turn to Lisa in Rochester. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. I take a little issue with this mentally ill thing, and although I'm all for mental health, believe me when I say it, but I think a lot of this is, these young people are getting radicalized. They're tuning into these insane conspiracy channels, 4chan, 8chan. And, when you think of young, in the Muslim countries, they get radicalized there. That's happening here. Domestic terrorism is an issue here. Is there anything we can do about that? And yes, I'm all for gun safety. Yes.
Okay.
That's a biggie for me.
Senator Rath, what do you think?
Well, thank you, Lisa, as well for your call. And I have three children as well, 20, 18, and 16. And I'll tell you, the forces that are influencing our kids these days is like nothing else. And we, in many ways, we can't relate because we're not on our phones, on our devices, using the internet, or being influenced the way that they are. It's extremely scary, the forces that were at play here with this disaster that happened and this tragedy that happened in Buffalo. And I do think that mental health is a very, very important piece of it. It's not the panacea. It's not the sole solution, but I think it's something that we need to look at very, very closely. And this was an act of domestic terrorism. There's no question about it. And we need to work and turn over every stone to figure out how we can solve this problem for the residents of the state of New York.
Senator, Mike in Brighton calls in to say that, other countries like Australia changed its laws, and Australia gets held up a lot. There was a mass shooting, I think, in the late 90s, and there was a massive, significant reduction in guns. There was actual confiscation that went on, and that is held up as sometimes as an example of what could be done. Do you view that as simply outside of American tradition and not something you're interested in? Is that part of the conversation that you would entertain?
You know what? I'll entertain every conversation, Evan. And, you know, I think all of us as state senators, as members of the state assembly, you know, we comprise the state legislature, and all of us should be willing to see, you know, what's working in other areas, what's not working in other areas. There's a lot of times in which you don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? You can see what's happening and you can learn from other countries, other communities as to what might be the highest and the best use and the best approach to handling this. And this is unfortunately the latest example that we saw in Buffalo, and it's happening all over the world. And so let's look at every possible model and figure out what we can do to work on fixing this. And I have heard that this is something that is going to be very rapidly considered in the state legislature. And, you know, I'm here in Albany. I'm standing in my office in Albany right now, as a matter of fact, before we have session this afternoon. And when things come before us, let's work on it together. And you know what? And let's also work on it together in a balanced and a reasonable way. We don't need to be disagreeable on these issues.
Let me get one more call on this issue, and then we're going to turn to some other state business here. This is a different Lisa in Rochester. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Good morning. I appreciate the senator's words about the hateful rhetoric and divisions and domestic terrorism. I fully agree that this is part of a pattern of hateful rhetoric that has, you know, magnified harm against, you know, Jews, blacks, immigrants, people who are not, you know, not part of a certain group, and so they're demonized. I'm asking whether the senator would help lead the fight against politicians using marginalizing rhetoric against groups that helps foment this, because I'm a registered Democrat, but we need Republicans to speak up against this, and I would hope the senator would be part of leading that at this point.
Okay, go ahead, Senator Reth.
Yes, thank you, Lisa, for your comments, and I will share with you this. When we have this type of pattern, hateful behavior against any one of us in our community, it's against all of us. And as such, we have a responsibility, myself as an elected official, to work and do whatever we can to all of us lead, and all of us lead the fight to making sure that this doesn't happen again. And the rhetoric and the hatred and the harmful language that is used is so counterproductive and so counterintuitive at the juncture that we're at right now. Let's put all that behind us and let's start to work on solutions. That's the best way to approach this. And you know, it's so often that we get so bogged down in sort of the frenzy and the energy and the partisanship of the moment. And that's not what we need right now. We need to be working on possible solutions for our communities.
What do you think is driving white nationalism in this country right now? What do you think is stoking it the most, Senator?
I wouldn't have really, I don't think, a good explanation for that. I mean, it's shameful, it's evil, it's absolutely wrong, and it needs to be rooted out in our communities all over the country, no question about it. But I couldn't tell you what's specifically stoking it. I don't think there's an easy answer to that question.
Sure. Lisa is saying that she thinks that there is an element of the Republican Party, especially at the national level, that is stoking it. Do you agree with that?
I would challenge that. I don't think it has anything that's tied to a specific political party. I don't think that that's accurate. I think that it is rooted and grounded in extremist behavior and extremist individuals who are, you know, gathering their information from wherever they're gathering information from, and it's all going into sort of this building crescendo, if you will, of hatred.
I understand. I think you're probably in a tough spot. You know, you're a Republican senator in the state of New York. It's a party that doesn't always have a lot of political power, and I understand that you're focused on state business. But I'm asking that, you know, not to sort of be unfair or disagreeable, but because we've been talking about 4chan and 8chan. We'll talk about that next hour with our guests. But it's not just there. And one example of where we're hearing the kind of rhetoric that literally ended up in the words of the man who went to Buffalo to commit a mass shooting is nightly on Fox News. Listen to Tucker Carlson here.
I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it, that's true. I have less political power because they're importing a brand new electorate. Why should I sit back and take that?
Do you agree with that, Senator?
Well, I just heard a portion of it, right? I don't know contextually everything of what he's referring to here. I would have to probably hear more of the interview and more of the discussion to understand what Tucker Carlson was talking about there. But like I said earlier, you know, words have an impact. And, you know, we all have to be very, very careful with, you know, what we're putting together by way of rhetoric and words and perspective and guidance and all the rest. And if it's from the left, if it's from the right, you know what, we need to be a lot more careful. And we're seeing that, unfortunately, that, you know, some of the real hateful information that is out there. And then I don't think what Tucker said was hateful in any stretch of the imagination, but there is language out there that's very hateful. And that could have been what's fomenting this action that happened in Buffalo.
How do you, I mean, I cannot understand how you can say what you just heard, you need context for, or you don't think it was hateful. He called, quote, third world immigrants obedient, as if they're not their own people with brains and thoughts and their own minds, who happen, by the way, to be more politically conservative than a lot of people might expect. Sometimes they're fleeing far-left dictatorships in Latin America. I mean, they're not a monolith. And to call them just obedient sort of tokens of the Democratic Party, you don't think that's hateful?
Well, again, it was the first time I heard that, Evan, and I can't really respond accurately without really, I guess, delving into the issue, right? And so, you know, I understand what you're saying, and, you know, I think it's something that, again, and for me and my perspective in government and in general, it's, you know, let's push aside the hardcore hateful rhetoric and let's work together. That's how government gets things done. It doesn't get things done on any of the ideological extremes. That's the perspective I was trying to explain.
Senator Edward Rath III is our guest. We're going to take our only break. We're going to talk about bail reform and some other issues at state business that the senator has his eyes on. Recently concluded a state budget. There's a lot to discuss. His district stretches from Rochester to Buffalo. He's been weighing in on the tragic mass shooting of this past weekend and a lot more. And we'll get right back to him after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, the first in a series of conversations specifically about the mass shooting in Buffalo. We're talking about white replacement theory, the toxic ideology that led the shooter to drive several hours to find a predominantly black neighborhood and target black people. What do we need to know about this and what can we do about it? We'll talk about that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Senator Edward Rath III is our guest for the hour, talking about the recent state budget and state business, along, of course, with the tragic events of this past weekend. What is top of mind for you? You mentioned bail reform. Can we start there, Senator? Can you give me a sense for how you feel about where things have moved and where you still would like them to go?
Sure. We have now had three versions of changes to the original cash bail, elimination of cash bail reforms in New York State. And I still think we haven't in any way solved the issue or solved the problem. And a couple things I think we need to look at. Number one, we have taken the discretion away from the judges with regards to people who are threats to our community. I think we should restore that judicial discretion. Secondly, the discovery rules that DAs have to comply with regards to sharing of information has made the life of our district attorneys very, very difficult with regards to complying with the discovery rules. And I've heard from DAs that said that there are times in which they can't pursue cases because they can't comply with the discovery rules in such a short timeline. And lastly, you know, we're seeing many, many individuals who are going back out into our communities when they're released without bail, and they are committing crimes again and again. So to me, and I say this all the time about government, if we're getting something wrong, leadership in government is going back to the drawing table and working on getting it right and fixing it. So I think what we should do with this is we should repeal this and go back and work on fixing it. Yes, there are many areas in which, you know, cash bail is very, very difficult, and for people of lesser means, it's restrictive and is punitive. I understand that, and I agree with that, and it should be addressed. But the overall legislation, I think, is flawed in many ways. So I think state government should go back and fix it and start over.
So if the system that they were attempting to fix with these versions of bail reform was overly punitive, as you say, what is an appropriate fix without overreach, in your view?
Well, I think that's a very nuanced and it's a very specific question on how we can correct this. And what I'd like to do is, and I've referenced this approach in the past, is talk to the judiciary, talk to the legal community, talk to our law enforcement, everyone who's involved in this, and say, how can we make sure that this is working properly? I've had judges who've called me and said that they are very concerned because they don't have the tools that they need to protect our communities. And when I'm hearing that, I say, okay, well, then we have to really, really work on fixing this. So let's go back to the drawing board, talk to the experts, and work on fixing it. That's good government, and that's how I believe we should address this problem.
Okay. Do you feel that you can address this issue in a way that satisfies people, as you say, in judiciary, people in sheriff's departments, people who have been activists for change? Is there something that satisfies everyone?
I believe there is a balance we can strike on this one because there's an awareness that something had to be done, and I believe it went too far, and so now we're trying to scale it back. Maybe we went from A to Z, and then it was A to T, now it's A to O, if you see what I'm saying, going backwards in the alphabet. The point being is that let's repeal it, let's start over, let's fix it. And that's leadership in government. And a lot of times it's very hard to get that mentality and that approach across. But at the end of the day, you have good outcomes when you do that.
What do you think the harms are of the system before? If you said it was overly punitive at times, who do you think was harmed?
Well, I think it was very difficult for people, like I said, of lesser means, who didn't have the wherewithal to be able to be to post bail and to be released back into the community pending their hearings before the judge. So we need to be mindful of that, no question about it. And that's one area that I know that was in part one of the strategies in the beginning was to address that issue, but I think it went too far. And now, like I said, we've been scaling it back. To me, we should trust in the judiciary, who these are obviously the preeminent experts on the law, and they have major concerns with it. Our district attorneys have major concerns with it. So if that's the case, let's work on fixing it.
Let's hit a few other points of state business that might have been higher up on the list, if not for recent events here, but I do want to make sure we talk about a few of them. First, in general here, how do you feel about the budget itself that recently passed, and what is in there that you say much needed, and what is in there that you say, I've got an issue with that?
Okay. Well, there's a number of things with the budget that I had some major concerns with. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is a $42 billion increase in spending to the state budget over the last 2 years. That's an 18% increase in the last 2 years. That is a rampant increase in spending. And to me, that's unsustainable. I think it's also fiscally irresponsible for our government to be spending that amount of money year over year. And what's going to happen long term, when you're in this scenario where your budget is now $220 billion, is we're either going to have to at some point raise taxes, or at some point we're going to have to cut services. And I warned my fellow state senators on this issue on the floor when we were debating this. I said, this is what's going to have to happen, and we don't have to increase this massive amount of spending year over year. We also had large surpluses that we're carrying over. I believe some of that surplus money should have been given back to the residents and the businesses of the state of New York. We had the capacity to do that. Instead, what we did was increase programs that increase services. So I do think that there was some good that was in the budget. Certainly the increase in money for education, a very large supporter of that. I always have been. Our schools and our teachers need the resources, need the funding, need the prioritization out of their state government. Also infrastructure. I've always been a big proponent of investing in our infrastructure, because when you invest in infrastructure, you create jobs, you improve quality of life, but you also guarantee the public safety of our communities. So the schools and the infrastructure money was a very good thing, but I will tell you that there are other aspects of the budget that also caused me some concern. If you look at the components of what we did with regards to, aside from spending, there was a huge increase in pork barrel discretionary spending that lawmakers dole out every year. And I just think that that is bad for taxpayers and good for politicians. I think that the taxpayer-funded college tuition for prison inmates and non-U.S. citizens, that's something we should have worked on and talked about and not just forced through in the budget process. It's a little bit more of a policy issue and not a spending issue. And, you know, there's many other aspects that I think are going to create a lot of economic uncertainty for the residents of the state of New York. We are seeing rampant inflation, you know, 7-8% inflation, and we are not in many ways, I think, providing fiscal solutions for the residents of the state. And we have taxes that are 45th out of 50. We have regulations which are 46th out of 50. And New York State's affordability is 50th out of 50. Right now, we have a fiscal train that is running rampant and unchecked, and I think we have to have more fiscal constraint in our state.
So a couple of points there. When you mention college education for prison inmates, the argument that I've heard advocates of such make on is sometimes they bring it from a fiscal conservatism point of view. They say that it costs, what, $60,000 to $70,000 a year to incarcerate a person in the state, and the rate of recidivism in the state's very high. And so for a much, much smaller amount, you can offer college courses to someone who is a prison inmate, which increases the chances that they don't engage in recidivism and they're not back draining taxpayer money as a future inmate again. Does that appeal to you?
I understand what you're saying, and there's some merit to that perspective, but I also know, I'm not sure that it right now is when we are, you know, in a scenario where money is very tight in our state, if that's the highest and the best use of the taxpayers' money right now. The recidivism concern is always going to be something that is going to be high on my priority list in rooting out the recidivism. But, you know, this is, in many ways, I think, more of a policy perspective, as I had mentioned earlier, and not a financial perspective. And the budget is supposed to be designed for the state's finances, not the state's policies. And we're seeing more policy, as I said, interjected into a fiscal plan. And we should be going through the legislative process and not the financial process for that type of an idea.
It sounds to me like you think it's just not the right thing to do.
Well, it's something that, like everything else, is we've been talking about. Let's explore it. Let's review it. Let's look at the data.
I mean, like, when do we explore it? There's been a lot of talk this hour, but we should have the conversation. Like, have you not had these conversations?
On this issue, no, specifically not. On that specific taxpayer-funded college tuition issue, I have not. And, you know, is it the best, you know, plan for the state finances right now to be spending that money? I'm not sure. I need to have that conversation with someone who can explain to me that it is.
Okay, separately, I think the number for the Buffalo Bills Stadium was $600 million. Am I remembering correctly?
That's the state portion, correct.
Are you comfortable with that?
You know, I am. And $600 million from the state, $250 million from the county, and $550 million from the Pagoula ownership group. And I believe this is an investment in Western New York. I believe that the state certainly has a role. I think all three parties have a role in this, a public-private partnerships per se. And, you know, we've made these type of investments all across the state from state resources. And the stadium absolutely needs to be built. We've got about 4 years of life left on the current stadium, Highmark Stadium, and I believe long-term it's going to provide not only a benefit with the Bills staying in Western New York, but also a benefit for our community. I think it's going to be more utilized than the current stadium is for other types of events. I also have seen some statistics where the return on investment is about $35 to $40 million a year, net, when you net everything down. So if that's the case, you know, it pays for it certainly over the life of a 30-year lease.
How do you feel about what the state has done in terms of legalization with marijuana and some of the rollout that we're going to be seeing in various places on that?
Sure. This was an issue that I actually debated on the floor of the Senate. And some of the questions that I asked in the debate of Senator Krueger, who was a sponsor of legislation, was, I said, have we received perspective and sign-off from law enforcement with regards to what their plan will be once this is legalized? Then I asked if there was a clear perspective from addiction services. And my third set of questions was tied back into something we were talking about earlier this hour, which is mental health. And I wasn't totally convinced with her answers on all three responses to that. So I said, are we rushing this through without getting the perspective and the sign-off and the assurances that the infrastructure is in place with regards to legalization of marijuana before we're approving it? And she said, we'll work on that after it's passed. And I said, that's not sufficient for me. I said, we need to have, I believe, legislation that addresses all of those concerns without trying to figure out after the fact.
Okay. Well, let me just squeeze in one more email from a listener. Bob writes about how he thinks gun control doesn't work. He says, Evan, your guest and I probably agree that gun control does not work. Please ask why there is not a collective responsibility of gun owners and those that promote gun ownership for those gun owners that act irresponsibly. A previous caller mentioned the constitutionally required militias. A gun and its owner should belong to a militia, and that militia should be responsible for the acts of all of their members. Restore the Second Amendment. That's from Bob. What do you think, Senator Rath?
Well, the Second Amendment's in place right now, and you know, there are all sorts of rights that are protected for gun owners, and I support those rights that are protected for gun owners. When it comes to reconstituting a militia, I'm not sure I understand what he's leaning towards and what he's trying to accomplish with that. I think what we need to do right now is make sure that the laws that we have in place right now are protecting the right to bear arms while at the same time protecting our communities.
Finally, back in 2014, Rob Astorino was the Republican candidate for governor, and there was talk at the time in Albany about the Women's Equality Agenda, a 10-point agenda, and the 10th and final piece of that was codifying Roe v. Wade. I asked Rob Astorino about that, and Astorino told me, he said, look, Roe v. Wade's the law of the land is not going away. States do not need to be getting involved in stuff anymore. It's done deal. And turns out that that was wrong. And so, you know, we're not a state that's likely, given the political dynamics, to see movement in terms of restricting abortion. But I'm curious to know if you would like to see that happen, given the fact that states will now have the chance to do that, Senator.
Well, Roe v. Wade is now codified in New York, and it's the law of the land, and it can't be changed. And I think that, you know, what we need to do is realize that New York State has accomplished that. So there's no real changes to, you know, what will be happening with regards to abortion rights and abortion services in our state.
I guess what I'm asking is if you want to if you would prefer to see New York go in the direction of a couple dozen other states where there were restrictions or elimination of options.
Well, I mean, at this juncture, we really it's already a done deal. So I'm going to basically stay with the perspective that Roe v. Wade is codified and it's the law of the land in the state of New York, and there's really nothing we could do to change it.
State Senator Edward Rath III joining us about a wide range of issues. As I mentioned earlier this hour, it's part of a series of conversations with lawmakers when the budget is passed to get their perspective on state business. And this conversation just happened to fall at a time where we are dealing with the tragedy in Buffalo. And that's where Senator Rath is from. I know it's hit everybody. Senator, thank you for your time. It's good to talk to you. We'll talk to you again soon.
Evan, thank you very much. Good to talk with you as well.
Senator Edward Rath III joining us from Albany. Listeners, a full conversation next hour about some of the kinds of ideologies that lead to the mass shooting we saw this past weekend. That's coming up next.